Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Talk is Jericho, baby.
Here with Billy Mitchell, and it's been a big week for you, big few weeks, Billy, after years of this kind of controversy of you and your record-setting point scores. They were finally reinstated, and your records are now back where they belong with you.
I do appreciate it, sir. Yes, they were restored. I'm satisfied with the resolution to the whole matter. You know, it's like anything. In the end, there's always a few more things to do. There's other things on your list. There's things you want to achieve, you want to accomplish. And I guess that's where the future will lead us.
So what was the issue with you? I mean, obviously, I've seen King of Kong so many times. It's a great documentary. But what was the problem with your records? And why was there such controversy in allowing them to stand, shall we say?
Well, the actual scores, as they happened, didn't have any problems. They weren't contested in any way. Years later, looking at the videos or copies of the videos, it was said that the transition screens in between look different from what the arcade would produce. I'm not smart enough to even describe that. So a lot of people weighed in. A lot of people gave their opinions. There were opinions both ways, but they saw to it that the opinion that would weigh against me is what they went with.
Mm-hmm.
So basically we had to go back and we had to. The very first thing I did was I went back and I redid the scores. I redid them reasonably quickly. I always say when you tell me you can run a 5-minute mile and I say you can't, then I stand there and watch you run a 5-minute mile. You think it'd be time to zip.
Right.
So that was the first thing. But then we had to slowly go through and we had to gather up everything we needed that would make any sound person convinced. And that happened for a lot of things. But there was a lot of unfinished business. And to be honest, we just couldn't seem to get together with an agreement as to what may or may not have happened. But then eventually we did.
And these are records for Donkey Kong and Pac-Man. Those are kind of your two specialties, right?
Yeah, it was mostly about that. Basically, they subjected all the records I had all the way back to 1982.
Mm-hmm.
But those were the two main that had focus upon them.
What were some of the other games besides those ones?
Well, I don't want to say that you're of the right age bracket.
I am.
You remember Centipede?
Of course.
Ms. Pac-Man?
Mm-hmm.
Burger Time? Donkey Kong Jr.? Pac-Man, Donkey Kong, really, it was those. I always chose those games because those games were at the core of popularity.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't obscure. They were games that everybody was playing. Everybody who played them wanted to be the best.
Mm-hmm.
I always said that I could take you and I could take you out somewhere and I could show you how to play Bomb Jack or something like that. You could have the world record because you're the only one that submits a score on it.
Right.
So you always wanted to be at the game that had the most intense competition, because that's where you gain the most satisfaction and the most bang for your buck.
Well, and so what are your scores? Like, I know that there's a perfect score in Pac-Man, and obviously King of Kong delves mostly into Donkey Kong, but what exactly does that mean, like a perfect score?
In Pac-Man, there's 256 boards. So you play 256 boards. Of course, you never miss a dot or an Energizer, but you never miss a Blue Man. You never miss a prize. You play 256 boards. You never die once. If you die once, you cheat yourself out of 90 points.
Hmm.
A funny story is I'm standing there. You know, some people wonder where this tie came from. I was playing against Captain Canada. He actually wore a cape. You can look him up online. We were friends, but we were rivals.
Uh-huh.
And he actually scored 90 points shy of a perfect score right in front of me. I'm standing right like this watching him. And he came up 90 points short. It was that intense. And, of course, then I scored a perfect score. And then let me give the guy credit. Not long after that, he played again on the same machine, and he scored a perfect score.
Hmm.
Had timing been different, had the roles been reversal, then you'd be talking to Captain Canada right now. But that's what a perfect score was. And as you reach out to Namco, who created it, they had no idea. They never thought anybody would score that high, that long. It takes somewhere between 4 and 6 hours to do. It was something incredible. But what was really cool back then, back in the 80s, when you were doing these things, there wasn't computers where you could push a button, you could zip up to the level you want to and see what it's like.
Mm-hmm.
You would play and play and play. You'd play for hours to get to that point. You'd have people around you. They wanted to see what you were doing. Literally, I had people describe it to me. They said it was like 500 years earlier when people were setting sail, and who knew what they would find out there.
Right.
It was like when somebody went into space, what would actually happen? And you didn't know until you actually did it. You know, mm-hmm. It made you feel like a pioneer, like you were something different or special, or you were unveiling something to the world. So it was a really cool feeling. Again, that's stolen now because we have computers who can put you right there. But that's what it was like back then.
There was such a culture back then amongst arcades. You know, like you mentioned, I mean, they still have arcades now. There's a lot of barcades and that sort of thing. But when we were growing up and you were, you know, 15 years old, going to the arcade was a full, I'm sure for you, it was a daily thing almost, but it was at least on the weekends. Go to the arcade, go hang out, find the game that you like. You know, I was always a Galaga guy, but then there'd be some guy that was really hot, you know, playing Pac-Man or whatever. And people would be gathered around, like you said, almost like the pinball wizard of watching. And of course you were one of those guys of just having this whole connection with people just watching you play.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned Galaga, because let me give props of the games of yesterday that still get obsessed over today. I'd like to tell you that it's Pac-Man. I'd like to tell you that it's Donkey Kong. It'd be a feather in my cap, but I'd lie to you if I didn't tell you at least equal to those is Galaga.
Yeah.
Galaga is incredible. I mean, it has different platforms. It has different forms that people talk and share strategies and competitions with. It has its own contest. It has its own championships. I mean, that just doesn't happen with Centipede, you know, and Centipede was a great game. But going to the arcades was incredible. You would go there in the morning and you would have no indication, no desire, no prediction as, well, I'll be home at 4 o'clock.
Right.
No, you would basically come home about when you were ready to drop.
Yeah.
And that's basically what we did. And it's so cool to look back at history, and it's well documented that movies and music, because of the arcade of the early 80s, they took a significant financial hit because they occupied people's time and attention to such a degree. It's funny because video games were great, but as you were alluding to, it was the arcades that made the atmosphere, that made the games great,
mm-hmm.
that made the environment, which made the culture, a culture that lives on today. It's simply transforming into something, as you indicated, a barcade. And that's so cool.
Yeah.
It's something that refuses to die. It just continues to evolve.
How did you start playing games, Billy, to where, you know, you knew that you were really good at these at these things?
I started in the world of pinball. I mean, obsessive.
Hmm.
But as the 70s turned into the 80s, the attention, the competition, the popularity shifted from pinball to video games. I mean, you might find it hard to believe that I enjoyed the competition, you know, but I do. And so I took and I turned my focus from pinball over to video games. And of course, like anybody else initially, I was just another guy playing. But I started to get good and really good. And I have this humor that I couldn't get next to that yellow cabinet. There were so many people standing around it, I couldn't even get to it. So I says, well, this one's busy too, but I can get to it. And it was Donkey Kong.
Hmm.
And I started playing and obsessing. At first, nobody could beat me. It just wasn't going to happen. So then I started traveling to other arcades. And at the other arcades, again, nobody could beat me. I'd find whoever was the best, but I was better. It got to be where I was running around, 18 years old, and my dad took the family to the World's Fair. And every time the car stopped at a rest area, I got out of the car and I ran around to see what games were there and what the high scores were. he'd gas up and I'd get back in the car and we'd go. So that was the level of obsession. And it wasn't until I finally learned through Joystick Magazine that there was the beginnings of what we call esports, the beginning of organized competition, the beginning of trying to create something that was certified, something that had a meaning to it, you know, a database. And that began to lead to organized competitions. You know, I'd like to turn the tide a little bit. Picture what I said, and let me say it to you. When did you begin to realize that you could beat the hell out of most anybody? You know?
Well, the thing is, too, though, Billy, like, once again, like, coming from our generation, I think we're a few years apart. Like, it was so much wrestling, heavy metal, but video games were such a big part of that. So yes, I was watching wrestling obsessively, listening to music, but always playing video games. And once again, even when the home systems came in with like Atari and that sort of thing, I think all of that just opened up your imagination to like, what can I do? Like, this is such a, the sky's literally the limit, right? Like, you, like there was such a kind of a cool fantasy element to it. But like you said, you could win. You could win some of these games, you know, and that to me was kind of motivational as a teenager.
Yeah, one of the things that was cool was you talk about all the different cultures that were out there, from wrestling to music to video games. And of course, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
They were all so strong that they began to integrate. You remember there was a video game called Journey?
Yeah.
Okay.
The faces of Journey were like flying around.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like Steve Perry's head is like a, got lasers you can shoot.
Yeah, and to be honest, it's bad for me to say, it wasn't a very good game.
No, it was a terrible game.
But it was a game, and it caused two cultures to cross.
Yes.
And therefore it was popular. Find a Journey machine today.
Yeah.
And you'll find a bag of money. But again, there were many games, martial arts, wrestling.
Yeah.
Again, they crossed paths. And I don't know that any one of them were great games, but they were great because they brought worlds together.
Yeah, there was a game called Exciting Hour. It was from, I think it was T-A-I-T-E-O, whatever.
Yeah,
and it was a wrestling video game, but you could tell it was very much Japanese influenced and created. And man, I was obsessed with that thing to the point my very first job that I had working at the Canadian version of Target, on my lunch break, I went and played and I did so well. I got to the fifth guy, which is like the final boss, and I beat him. But I was so late to come back to work, they almost fired me. And I said, please don't fire me on my first day. My dad will kill me. I'm so sorry. I just got to the final boss in Exciting Hour. They're like, I don't know what you're talking about. Don't ever do it again. But that's the obsession was there, you know?
Right. Well, it's funny. You talk about that obsession. You talk about people getting late for work or missing work, kids being late for school or skipping school.
Yeah.
The obsession was so great. One of the ways that the world retaliated against video games was they regulated them. They taxed them.
Hmm.
X amount of dollars per game, you know, per year in a location. The thing is, it was funny. It shows human nature. It shows the government. As the arcades went out of business, as games were less and less, as games were not creating that revenue, not arcade games, somehow they lost all interest in regulating them.
Oh, really?
Because they couldn't produce a dollar back for them. It kind of shows you. I'm surprised they don't try to regulate or tax home games, because obviously video games are more popular than they've ever been before. You just don't have to go to the arcade.
Did you have the home systems too, like the Atari and Nintendo, those types of machines?
I actually didn't. And as the 80s turned into the 90s, and obviously they became more popular, the companies that I had gained a relationship with, they sent it to me for me to try out ahead of time, sworn to secrecy that I wouldn't share with anybody. And first of all, I couldn't get to it because my son was all over it. So basically, I took what my son had to say about it, all the good news and all that, you know, he learned from it. And I put it into my own words and I sent them back my opinion, which obviously was very favorable. It was a great system. But yeah, that happened a number of times. But I never dove into the home games. As a teenager in the arcade, I could go there 10 and 12 and 14 and 18 hours in a day. I could go as many days as I want. Yeah, outside of school, I didn't really have any responsibilities. And so on a regular basis, I get asked by people, well, how come you don't play a new game? You know, how come you don't play Call of Duty? If I took that time,
right?
First of all, I wouldn't have a wife, a house, a business, kids. I wouldn't have anything. That's point one. And that's honesty. But I'll get more honest. I see my son play. I play with a joystick and a button. He plays and he uses all 10 fingers. I don't know how he does that.
Yeah.
And then the most honest thing I say is I'm not going to play anything that my son can beat me at, and he'd whip me at every one of them. I got to stay in my territory.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
So, Billy, when you were, you mentioned, you know, going to these different arcades and then you're finding the beginning of esports, because there's you know, the beginning of King of Kong shows you like on Life magazine, and it was a big culture. How big did you get, you know, at that? Was it a national thing? Was it a worldwide thing?
Well, there at Life magazine, there were guys international. Mm. They were from the U.S. They were from Canada, but it certainly gained worldwide recognition being a full page spread in Life magazine. Mm-hmm. Now, I always say that that's where my obsession took full throttle, because I was there at Life magazine. I was amongst what was considered to be, I don't know, about 18 or 20 best video game players in the world. And the cameras of Life magazine staring at you. Mm-hmm. And the night before the photo shoot, I set a world record on Donkey Kong. I hit history's first kill screen. The people standing around me didn't know what would come, hadn't seen it, and they were the best in the world. Hmm. They were truly the smartest guys I ever met in my life. And to do that there, you could hear a pin drop in the arcade because every eye was focused on the screen. And to stand up and turn around and see the best players in the world looking at your performance, again, with the cameras of Life magazine, that forever created an obsession I had to play and play and play and be the best. And it had to spread from one game to another to another to another. I think probably everybody has that point that pushes them over the edge.
Let's explain what a kill screen is, because once again, I know what it is, but it's such a mythical thing. Explain what that is and how you even found out that there was such a thing, because you mentioned you were the first player in history to get to the kill screen.
Well, I actually got to the kill screen in the summer of 82. I didn't really know what was going on. I'm scratching my head. I go, why did my game just end? That was a Donkey Kong. Mm-hmm. And so now I went to Life magazine in November, and I'm playing. And I had talked to people that something's going to happen in the upper 800,000s to 900,000s. It's going to be level 22. And it's not explained then. And it's not known by Nintendo what happens. It is now, all these years later. It was funny because the guy who was considered the best player was right next to me. He played a game right in front of me. He got 190,000 points. And back in 1982, if you played Donkey Kong and you got 190,000 points, every eye in the arcade would be on you. Mm-hmm. You would absolutely be the center of attention in that arcade. He got 190,000, and then it was my turn. He stood next to me. And he watched me get 849,000 on my first guy. And then a short while after that, the kill screen happened and we all stood up and everybody had their opinion as to what happened. And not one of those opinions is true today. But again, that kill screen, for me to describe it, basically the game, the code, as it goes on, it collapses within itself, just hits a bug. Mm-hmm. And instead of having 80 seconds to get to the top of the screen, you have about 5 seconds. Mm-hmm. So it's game over. Now in Pac-Man, you play and play and play. You play and you get more 255, which is normal, outrageously difficult. And then you hit 256. There's enough within the game for half of the screen that's normal. And the other half is computer garble. You may have seen pictures of it.
Yeah.
But it just knocks you off your feet when you see it. You don't know what it means or why. There's nothing there that is any indication hardly of Pac-Man. And it's just nothing but a chaotic mess that instantly leads to death. But over the years, again, we learn how to cheat death.
How do you cheat the computer then?
Well, what happened was, obviously, through a little skill, but a lot of accident, we realized how to trap the guys along the side of the screen. They were trapped in an alleyway. They couldn't get out. You were free to roam the screen and try to find what you could. There's 244 dots on the screen. So half of them are lost to computer garble. So in that computer garble, we managed to find 11 dots. Nine you could eat, two you couldn't eat. Each time you eat them and then you purposely die, those nine reappear. So now you understand why the guy from Canada came up nine dots short, is because he got there on his second guy. Now that I think about it, he's Captain Canada, and you're Canadian. I don't know if I'm in for a rough interview.
With your U.S.-American tie on. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So the kill switch then, it's not something that was put in there by the programmers. It's something that's caused by a computer bug?
Yes, normally it is. There's a couple games, I'm thinking of Crystal Castles, where you get to a perfect point, and they say, I give up, you win, the game comes to an end. There are a couple games like that, but most games have some type of kill screen or computer bug, and normally something that the programmer did not intend. It just happened. Again, back in the day, it was the coolest thing. Everybody was searching for the kill screen. Everybody wanted to see and do what no one else did.
Mm-hmm.
And then once it was discovered, everybody wanted to figure out a way past it. But there's a reason why it's called the kill screen, because it kills.
Yeah.
In Pac-Man, initially we called it the split screen, because the screen was split, half good, half bad. But then in the 90s, when we realized there was no getting past it, no matter what you did, then we started calling it the kill screen.
And you actually showed that to the creator, the designer of Pac-Man.
Yeah, both the guy they call the father of Pac-Man, Masaya Nakamura, who's the founder, CEO of Namco, and of course his inner circle, but also to the programmer, the developer, Professor Iratwani. Both of them just went like this. Didn't matter what question you asked them, they went like this. Those are experiences and relationships that I cherish. Masaya Nakamura has passed on, still in contact with others close to him. Professor Iatwani, he's actually teaching. I look forward to seeing him again. I'm supposed to see him later this year, and then again in 29, because that'll be Pac-Man's 50th birthday.
Let's talk about The King of Kong, the documentary. I mean, obviously it was some 15, 16 years ago, but how did that come about, and how were you approached to be a part of it?
When I did the perfect score on Pac-Man, I was contacted by Namco. I traveled to Tokyo to the Tokyo Game Show, where I was honored on stage as history's first perfect Pac-Man and player of the century.
And that's
3,333,360
is the perfect score.
So I always tell people that want to play, I say, come on, I'll play a penny a point. No, I'll go for it, though. But while I was there in Japan, Masaya Nakamura, who owned three movie studios, he predicted, and I got to say, I didn't put a lot of stock in his prediction, but he was right. He predicted, he said timing is everything, and he predicted that this event that brought tremendous attention back to classic gaming, he predicted that this event would lead to a resurgence or an interest in games from the golden age. And it was after that event in Tokyo that movie people started following us. I think at one time I counted there were seven different movie groups that were following us. Two of them that were just far bigger than all the rest, that outgunned all the rest. And those two eventually acquired the film footage from the others. And so there were two major films that came out. One was King of Kong. The other one was Chasing Ghosts. Basically, they started back in 1982, as you indicated before, following that same timeline and history of events.
Mm-hmm.
But they were filming and filming and filming, and none of them indicated to any one of us players exactly what it was they were targeting. And if you ask them today, whether they're truthful or not, they'll tell you that they didn't actually know what they were targeting until they gathered all their film.
Mm-hmm.
But they gathered all their film. One of them had more of a historical view of gaming. I mean, they did. And the other one had more of a competitive game playing view of video games. That was the King of Kong. And not that you'd be familiar with this, but this was the typical good guy, bad guy.
Of course.
Antagonist, protagonist.
Heel and baby face.
Yeah.
As we say in wrestling. I always say to people when I get them to check out, you got to check out King of Kong. It's the best wrestling story that has nothing to do with wrestling. Because obviously you're cast as the heel and Steve Wiebe's the baby face. And that's kind of the whole crux of the movie.
Right. I didn't have any indication until it came out at Sundance what their actual storyline was. Again, if they tell you what they tell you, they had 400 hours of film footage and exactly which way they would go.
Right.
You don't know. If you remember, there was the kind, wonderful older lady who played Qbert.
Yeah.
Well, there was a story there. it could have been expanded tremendously. But they touched upon it in the story that they did bring out. There were other competitive elements that, again, they could have expanded on, that they touched upon, but they kept the focus on King of Kong. I think now, all these years later, when they talk to me and they give me a little bit of honesty, they tell me that the history, the intensity, the emotion that they were looking for is something that I brought.
Mm-hmm.
I was more serious. I was less casual. It fit the narrative that they wanted. You know, I will tell you a secret that they won't tell you. They, between the director, a couple of producers, and Steve Wiebe, there was some relationship going back a considerable time.
Mm.
Exactly what that was, I don't know, but it's been spoken of in different stories. I don't think that matters any. I just know that they met with that side before they met with this side.
Yeah, there's a great documentary about bodybuilding in the 70s called Pumping Iron, where they portray Arnold Schwarzenegger the same way that they kind of portray Billy Mitchell, where he's kind of like intimidating Lou Ferrigno and just watching him training and saying, you know, you look good, Lou, not good as me, but you look good. Like, you just very much, because the way they have you, like, you're coming into the arcade, you're looking around, you're not talking to everybody, you're leaving. Like, this, it just was a really great, almost a cinematic portrayal.
Well, I think the way that they put things together, the way they create emotion, the way they create controversy, the way they make it intriguing. Some people love it. Some people hate it, even though they truly do love it. Some people find it interesting. Some people find it obsessive.
Mm-hmm.
They create such extremities of emotions. It makes me say to myself, gee, do I really want to tell them, say, Chris Jericho, the truth behind certain things and how they happened? Or should I leave the movie and the enjoyment as it is? It is something that I wrestle with from time to time.
What was the status of Steve Wiebe? Was he like legit your rival at Donkey Kong?
Absolutely. He was a great player. He was not around in the earliest days,
mm-hmm.
but his scores were absolutely legitimate. Some people have tried to say that his scores weren't, or that they aren't, or that he's next on the chopping block. That's just not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But you're always going to have those people. There's people who felt they were cut out or marginalized who weren't put in either one of the movies I spoke of. They're right. They weren't. They weren't because they didn't fit the narrative.
Right.
There were people who were deserving to be basically celebrated. They were. They do deserve to be celebrated. But they weren't part of that narrative. That's all. It easily could have went another way. It easily could have been focused on other games or things that didn't have to do with me or Steve Wiebe. And then again, you'd be talking to someone else.
Right.
Well, all I can say is, I mean, I can't help those people. But yes, he was that good and he deserved the recognition he got. There's times where I would easily say he was treated with greater favoritism
mm-hmm.
than he should have been. But I can easily say there were times where he was not treated as favorably as he could have been. That's the way it works.
Let's talk a little bit about Twin Galaxies, because it's such a big part of the movie, and even they're the ones who kind of decided to reinstate your records. What exactly is Twin Galaxies?
Well, in 1981, there was Twin Galaxies. Twin, there were two of them, opened, one in Iowa, one in Missouri. The one in Missouri closed, so we focus on the one in Iowa. And it was that one in Iowa where the scoreboard, the database, the clearinghouse for high video game scores and historical events began to be tabulated. Video games were making so much money, you couldn't get anybody's attention. You couldn't get anybody to want to have a contest. As I spoke to people back then, distributors, they said, oh, no, Bill, we just want to collect the quarters. You know what I mean? That's exactly what they were doing. But Twin Galaxies took it upon themselves to begin organizing and creating events like Life Magazine that you spoke of.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's incredible. A governor's visit, interaction, even phone calls from the White House, and eventual placement in Guinness World Records. Well, again, they became known as the database, the clearinghouse for all of this. And that went on for a long time, at least 30 years. And finally, the originator, Walter Day, stepped down or bowed out of it because he's, as he says, moving on to the next phase of his life, which is music. The greatest asset of Twin Galaxies is the historical aspect of it. In the day of modern games, other scoreboards, It's their history that's valuable, not the fact that there's one guy who's not sanctioned. He's in his apartment, still with the data on his laptop, still wanting to be relevant.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what's relevant. What's relevant is the history and how it's Twin Galaxies that was actually the benchmark for esports. Back then, we called it competitive gaming.
Mm-hmm.
But their relationship, both with manufacturers, with Guinness World Records and other authorities, that's what put competitive gaming on the map, without a doubt.
And it was very important to play. You mentioned the scoreboard, the electronic board that goes inside each unit. You had to play the same game, basically.
Correct.
Because different games might have different foibles to it, right?
Correct. As a matter of fact, the original rules, if you go all the way back to the 1984 edition of Guinness, and each time throughout the 80s that they printed the book, it actually said high scores are meaningless because every board, every joystick, every button, every environment can be very different. So what they would publish were scores that were done under contest settings or observation. So when Twin Galaxies had an event, it was that opportunity you had to put up that score. You did what I called a garage score back then. It didn't count.
Gotcha.
You could talk to your friends about it. You could talk to magazines about it, but it didn't make its way into Guinness. Again, this is long before the days of playing on Twitch, YouTube. I guess the earliest thing was Justin TV.
Mm-hmm.
But now that's considered live. But back then,
right,
the only live scores were the ones that you did at an event under observation, because it crossed the threshold of exactly what you're talking about.
Right.
As far as verification.
Well, that makes sense. It's just like, you know, powerlifting or something. You can bench press 500 pounds at your house, but until you do it in front of the judges at a contest, this stuff doesn't count.
Absolutely. It's long since been something that I've spoken of. Absolutely.
Quick question I have to ask you. Whatever happened to Mr. Awesome? He was your nemesis in the film.
Okay. So how much do I want to spoil the film?
Let us in. It's been a few years. We all know now that Pumping Iron, for example, was very set up and staged. Arnold has since admitted that.
I would be described, glorified, or criticized as an interesting character.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was certainly an interesting character. Wow, he was interesting. But I'll save that for another time. But what happened was, I originally met him in 1985, and the first time I met him, it seemed fine. The second time I met him, it didn't seem fine. He was just so unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, I detached myself from anything that he was involved in. And so I would regularly get asked, and this happened in The King of Kong, I would regularly get asked about him, to comment on him, or the conversations that I've had with him, or the rivalry, as you say, that I have with him.
Mm-hmm.
So I would basically sum it up as saying, let me tell you everything that I have said to him, every way that I've interacted with him since 1985. And I can give it to you right now. Are you ready?
Yeah.
That's it.
Nothing.
In 1985, I just thought he was so unpleasant that I just detached myself. But let me say, that doesn't mean he wasn't a great gamer. It doesn't mean he didn't achieve his scores.
Mm-hmm.
It just meant that I chose not to be there when he did. When I did see him play prior to that, his gameplay on his games was amongst the best I've ever seen. Maybe the best.
Wow.
I've chosen not to interact with him, that's all. But in the movie, again, as you say, they sell it as we have a nemesis, we have a rivalry, but we didn't.
When the movie comes out, did that kind of increase your name value? Or at that point, you're already so critically acclaimed? Like, I guess for people like myself would learn a lot more about who Billy Mitchell is and about the whole world of gaming. Did it kind of increase your fan base?
Well, to give you the history of it, if it was the 1980s or even 90s, I would occasionally have somebody come up to me. Those are people, hardcore gamers,
mm-hmm.
people who saw magazines, read articles, saw it in a newspaper, were familiar with stuff, and they would recognize me. And so they would come up, and that would happen once in a month, once every 2 months, once every 3 months, not often. But in the late 90s, here comes the internet. When the perfect Pac-Man happened, when that story ran around the world, it ran around the world in places you barely even knew existed.
Mm-hmm.
The contacts that came in, the people who wanted to speak, it went on every wire that I'd imagine. And that was just sheer good fortune for me. Again, it was the 4th of July weekend. It was the U.S. versus Canada. It was a quiet weekend. There was nothing in the news. There were no bombs that went off or any tragedies that happened anywhere. And it was a soft-hearted, happy-go-lucky story about a cultural icon that everybody was familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
So it got noticed. I don't think I could make that happen again, no matter how many times I tried. And the trip to Japan exacerbated it. I would say from that time of perfect Pac-Man, if I went in public every day for a week, 6 out of 7 days, I got stopped. I got a hello. I got a handshake. Oh, can I get an autograph? Oh, can I got a question. Selfies weren't really a thing then.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened. But when the King of Kong came out, it went from 6 days to 7, and even more so. It has been years, and I mean years, since I walked in public that somebody didn't stop me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can absolutely guarantee it. It's, again, I go in the bank. They don't say something to me every day. I mean, they know who I am.
Right.
If I walk anywhere in public, it never, ever, ever escapes. Long ago, before it was that popular, I promised myself that I would never unappreciate it. I never wanted to be that guy. And so I've never, ever said no to a hello, a hi, a handshake, a selfie, or a question or whatever. That's kind of tough sometimes when I'm running through the airport and somebody goes, ooh, and I got to stop. But again, I can appreciate every bit of it. By the same token, here's something that'll make you laugh. I always tell people that I'm an aggressive driver. I have my right to road rage. But now that people recognize me, I mean, I can't do that anymore. I got to
right.
I got to hate myself. When something happens, when you have a problem somewhere and somewhere where you might be upset or you want to tell somebody off or, you know, blow your stack, I just got to bite my tongue. I got to do it. You know?
So being kind of like, you know, critically acclaimed as the best video game player, you know, in history, the Eddie Van Halen of Donkey Kong and Pac-Man, is this something like, and I don't want to get too far into it, but is there, do people pay you to come do these, you know, meet and greets and stuff? Like, is there a financial aspect to it? Or is it like being a gold medal Olympian? It's more about the endorsees and stuff like that.
On a regular basis, I go to, say, Comic-Cons.
Yeah.
Conventions. They are paid appearances.
Of course, yeah.
Theoretically, they take people like me or people like you and they advertise that you're going to be there.
Yeah.
And then people want to come in. They want to see, meet, autograph, picture, selfie.
Mm-hmm.
I got to tell you, I do absolutely clash with the Comic-Cons because you go to a Comic-Con, you're supposed to sit at the desk. Somebody walks up. They want an autograph. You charge them for the autograph. And then you have an agreement with the venue as to how the money's split.
Mm-hmm.
I've told them, I said, I cannot sit there and autograph something and say, that's $50. I can't take a picture and say, that's $50. I mean, I just can't. I just don't. I won't. So what I do is I'll have a table full of merchandise, posters, mouse pads, hot sauce, whatever it is. And so somebody comes up and they make a purchase. And then anything they want autographed is free because they say, oh, gee, I want that poster. And I say, okay. And they say, will you autograph it? And I say, sure. So that's the way that I've kind of got around that, because that's just unbelievable to me that, gee, you have my autograph, now give me $50. And I know there's good people who do that every day. And I've met him. I mean, William Shatner is like an awesome guy.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he does for a living now. But I just,
Yeah, I got you.
It's a little difficult. But yeah, there's a lot of paid appearance offers,
mm-hmm.
more than I can obviously do because I have a normal life that most people don't know. I have a career. I have a wife and kids and a house. And that's where most of my attention goes. But to tell you, and you should be able to relate to this, one way I deal with it is, for example, I was invited to Newcastle, England. And the guy says, you know, what do you want? Well, it's, I need this, 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 and this. And he says, okay, deal. And I say, one catch. Yeah. I need 2 plane tickets. 2? Yeah. I take my wife. We go together. Mm-hmm. We're visiting Newcastle, England. It's an experience. It's a marital experience. It's a life experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's not me running off playing video games.
Right.
Again, when there's too much travel, it would impact that which is so important negatively. And that's why I said you should relate to this. There must be times where you have to make that decision as well.
Sure.
And one of the ways I've made that decision well, you know, I took my kids to Niagara Falls, exactly under the same idea that I just gave you. That was a life experience.
When you mentioned that when there was this, you know, dispute about your scores, and so you just went and, you know, ran the five minute mile in front of them, you got those scores back. Is that something that you just do off the top of your head, or do you still have to practice every day and play every day to keep up those skills?
Well, it's a good question. To expand on it a little, is I'll go weeks, months, brace yourself, even years without playing a game. But then I know something's up and coming, so I'm going to have to produce.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the perfect score was 4th of July weekend, 1999. Well, the 20th anniversary of 4th of July 2019, I wanted to do it again. Same place, same location, fun spot, the world's largest arcade. And I wanted to do it in honor of Bob Lawton, who was the owner and creator of Fun Spot. So months before, I started playing and dabbling. And what I knew back then came to me rather easily. And then more skill goes on top of that. So to answer your question, yes, I do have to.
Mm-hmm.
I sat there in July of 2018 after all of the allegations. I said, gee, I gotta play this again. I haven't done this since 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually my son who just wouldn't lay off me. He said, yes, you're going to do it. And so I started playing. And I repeated the scores, just as we said. But in addition to repeating the scores, then there was the Donkey Kong World Championship down in Australia. So we flew down to Australia. And there in Australia, I came in first place. And that's pretty funny. Come on, I want you to picture yourself in this position. There were 16, like in March Madness.
Mm-hmm.
The 16 became 8, became 4, became 2. Well, when it went from 16 to 8 to 4, the one I had to play against was my son.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So what's going to happen if you got to wrestle against your son? I mean, what are you going to do?
So he's just as good as a player as you are, or almost.
Yeah. I just said to him, I go, you know, you're my son. I go, you win. And I said, you can beat these guys. And of course, he wasn't going to let that happen. And he said, no. And we both agreed that we'd try as hard as we could. And ultimately, I won that. And it went down to me against another guy, a great guy, who won the year before and the year after. And I beat him. So to answer your question about having to play and practice, yeah, I did. And I went down and I came in first place. So I stood there and I got thumbs up and I got the belt. And I'm all happy and like that. And the guy comes up and hands me the envelope with the prize money. And then my son took the prize money. He didn't keep that. He said, he don't care about the title. He wanted the money.
So how does your son, obviously, I'm sure there's some genetics in there, but is this something that you trained him to play since at a young age and cultivated him to be this way?
Well, he has a very competitive and obsessive personality.
Mm-hmm.
He, if I can, I guess I'm going to brag a little here. His grade point average was off the chart.
Mm-hmm.
In the class of 2017 in high school, that was his class. On a national level, he was ranked number 7 as far as a receiver and number 2 as far as a kicker nationally.
Oh, wow.
And that got him into West Point.
Ah.
So he has a ridiculously competitive nature. You know, he says, or he gives me credit. He's kind. He says, you know, I didn't get here by myself, meaning him.
Mm-hmm.
But by the same token, he's a thorn in my side. I mean, he won't let me relax, but that's okay. He's that competitive. And when people ask him, geez, you came in third place down there, he just says, it wasn't very difficult. That's all he says.
As we start to wind down here, what are some tips for some of the games? Like, for example, you know, like for Donkey Kong, when you're playing, because it's still quite a popular game, and obviously not everybody's going to get to the kills screen. Nobody is. But what are some kind of things that a normal person like me could do to get better at Donkey Kong? And then I'll ask you the same about Pac-Man as well.
Well, the answer is the same for both of them. Again, something you have now that we didn't have in the 80s is if you go online, there are various websites and various individuals who create things that are strategies that take you from a very novice player, and it takes you at least to a mid-level player. It would take you to a level where you could probably play and beat any one of your friends. It's obvious strategies that when they're put in front of you, they make tremendous sense. But how would you stumble upon them if you were playing on your own?
Mm-hmm.
So when I get asked that question, I always tell people to actually go on and actually Google, you know, Pac-Man strategies or Donkey Kong strategies. They do work because, contrary to popular belief, the things you would read back in the 80s, Video Game Master's Guide to Donkey Kong, they didn't teach you anything. how to win at Pac-Man. The first way to win was not to rely on the book.
Right.
But yeah, there are a lot of stuff. They'll show you a lot of patterns, a lot of strategies. And they generally come from accomplished players. They do.
What I would always try and do in Pac-Man, I don't know if you have anything, but I have one of those units in my house that's got like 60 games on it. Mm-hmm. So I'll still play Pac-Man once in a while. And I always like eat as many dots as I can on either side of the power button and then wait there till the ghosts come and then eat the power button and try and get as many of them as you can. That's always my strategy.
Right. When you play Pac-Man, you can do that. And eventually you come to board 18. Mm-hmm. And that's the last board where you eat a power pellet and they turn blue. After that, they don't turn blue.
Really?
Yeah. So it gets harder. Yeah.
Do you have a unit in your house or do you just go to Fun Spot?
Yeah, I have they actually belong to a friend, but a Donkey Kong, Pac-Man, Miss Pac-Man, Galaga. And I'm putting together a game room that'll be like the ultimate game room in a house. When I get it done, I'll send you a video of it.
Yeah.
It's basically identical to an arcade that I had at the Orlando airport. And that was the most incredible arcade in the world, graphics wise. You stood in there, you thought you were standing inside of a video game. So that's what we're going to be creating at the house.
Last few things for you. I know obviously we're talking so much about your video game prowess, but you also have a very successful restaurant. And you mentioned the hot sauce earlier, Ricky's Hot Sauce. How does a guy who's so amazing at video games get into the hot sauce business?
It's funny. I've been asked that question, but not for a while. But it was about 1985. And I realized, you know, I mean, I was 20 years old. I realized I couldn't play video games forever, even if I wanted to. Mm-hmm. And there was not an avenue money-wise or career-wise. There just wasn't.
Right.
And so the family business and the major item in our business, which was chicken wings, basically I took the obsessive nature I have with video games and I put it over to the business. I was obsessed with the idea that we could make chicken wings and, of course, the main ingredient, hot sauce. I could make it better than anyone in the world. I mean, I had that. Mm-hmm. And so I began that obsessive nature. About 1988, that became my passion. Mm-hmm. Then in 91, that was all I worked on. And video games had fallen by the wayside years ago. And video games were reborn within me in 1999 with the Perfect Score.
Right.
But what I say gaming did for me is the obsessive nature I had to do my very, very, very best that translated over into the family business. And I just thought that I could do things or I could make things or create things or recipe things better than anyone in the world. And it actually wasn't as difficult as I thought, because what I did is I looked at, for example, a sauce that I thought was the highest quality one on the market. And all I did was target that one. I targeted that one and I just created a higher quality recipe. Again, I have to be humble here, a very dear, much older man who basically guided me to that point. And so giving credit where credit's due, and he has long since passed on. But it was something good that he did for me and something that I've been able to carry on. And what I like about it so much is within that business, I can make my own hours. I can make my own schedule. Mm-hmm. I never, ever missed anything my kids ever did growing up, ever, ever, never. They were never the kid that was sitting there without a parent.
Right.
And then when opportunities came along, like to go to Fun Spot or to go to Japan or to go to an event, again, I make my own schedule. So therefore, I was able to do it. It was a little, I won't lie to you. It was 1999. My son was a year and a half old and my daughter was 2 years old, or 2.5 years old, rather. And I had the opportunity to go to Japan. And I was so paranoid as I approached my wife to tell her about this opportunity. But she married this guy who's going to run off and play video games in Japan. And so I described her what the opportunity was. And her answer to me, which still chokes me up to this day, she says, you have to do what you enjoy in life. It makes the rest of life bearable. And so she was all in favor of me going and being honored and achieving and being rewarded for the hard work. And again, you asked me about my son. When I take my personality, or the better parts of it anyway, and I combine it with hers, again, we go back to the movie. You don't see my wife. They don't talk about her. Mm-hmm. When you read about her, they say she looks like, you know, the model who fell off the platform at the boat show. That doesn't necessarily hurt her feelings, because right. She's very accomplished. She has a PhD in education. She has an EdD. She's been a teacher for 33 years.
Right.
She's ridiculously accomplished. But I guess because she's so accomplished that she saw my opportunity to experience these things, and she told me to embrace them.
You must have really good hand-eye coordination. Like, I know, like Steve Wiebe was a drummer. Like, do you do anything else like that to be able to play and master these games so much?
Absolutely. I do. For example, you go to a truck stop, and they have those little triangles with those
pegs. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll say to somebody, I'll say, give it to me random. They'll give it to me with an open hole, and I'll go, and I'll leave one peg left in that hole. So yeah, there's a little bit of showboating that goes on. But I tell people, I go, I learned this again, going all the way back to Life Magazine, when I said those were the smartest guys I ever met. I described them as a group of guys. If you gave them a penny, you put them in a round room, they could find a corner to put it in. They were like that smart. I've seen guys do Rubik's Cubes behind their back.
Wow.
It was incredible. I say to people, I go, I or we, you actually see and hear things that other people don't. Things that are annoying as hell sometimes. I walk into a restaurant, and as I open the door, I can say, man, why don't they oil that door? Something you wouldn't notice. It can be like annoying. I walk in a restaurant and I go, no, we don't want to be here. Why? Because they're short staffed. How do you know? I know. I look at the number of tables, people waiting. It's almost useless information, and it sometimes will annoy the hell out of you. Yeah. So it doesn't make you any smarter or any richer. It just annoys you.
Right. Last question for you. What's your favorite game to play?
Whenever I play Pac-Man, I always get asked, what do you like better, Pac-Man or Donkey Kong? And I always say, right now, Donkey Kong. And if I'm playing Donkey Kong, I say Pac-Man. Donkey Kong is what started my world off, what brought me to Life Magazine, and put me on that trajectory. It did.
Mm-hmm.
But the highest honor that I ever, ever, ever received was the honor that was gifted to me by Masaya Nakamura and Namco in taking me to Japan. Not even the honor on stage. That was awesome. But the honor of sitting with him in his inner circle for a couple hours and discussing life and video games and the achievements and the accomplishments. As I said, when I sat with him, I said, there's not a kid in the world that ever, ever played video games who wouldn't want to be in this seat right here, right now. I would have to say that it's Pac-Man that brought me that honor. Favorite game, Pac-Man. Favorite game to play, maybe not Pac-Man, but definitely the favorite game.
Well, Billy, it's been great talking to you, man. I'm glad we're able to work this out. And congratulations on being reinstated where you should be with your records. And it's been a blast.
I thought I was going to get to ask you 100 questions now.
Well, we'll do that next round. It'll be your podcast. Talk is Billy Mitchell.
It was a pleasure, sir. Thank you very much.